Pipeline. Saturday night at the festival, the beer garden was in full swing. There was interference in the air, the drill of mosquitoes and June bugs harmonizing and phasing around the nagging of mercury vapor streetlights, all smudged together with the acid blanket of August humidity. George Cowsard took a swig of his beer, reached over and put his hand on the knee of his wife, Wanda. But his eyes were jealously glued to the group that was on the bandstand being a couple of flat hay wagons put together. The boys in the band were probably half his age and weren't any damn good. But these boys were up there, and George was not. And it ate at him. Back in February, when the festival was first being planned, George had called Rita McAfee, the committee chairperson, in an assumption that his band would have a lock on playing both Friday and Saturday nights at the beer garden. But Rita had been noncommittal, evasive even, and word eventually got around to George that the committee had hired a country band, a younger band, from a couple towns over. Rita never even called him. George and his band, the Lucky Dogs, had been playing around the four-county area for better than 25 years. They had played at every beer joint, every Elks and Legion and VFW hall around, a couple dozen 4th of July and Memorial Day picnics. They were the band for many a wedding reception and even several high school proms, back when they were reasonably the same age as that audience. Now the fraternal order still called them from time to time, but the beer joint gigs were rare. Most all were just jukeboxes now, and besides, they just stayed open too darn late. Wedding receptions had given way to 5th and 10th and 20th anniversaries, and old friends would sometimes have them play at the birthdays that landed on the decades or the fives. Watching these young shits on stage, George begrudgingly found himself tapping his foot. He became conscious that he was doing that not because the beat was good, but because it absolutely wasn't. His instincts were trying to find the groove of the song that this drummer could not. That ridiculous feeling that if he stomped hard enough, the band might hear him and get in step. "Come on, kid, slow down," George said to himself. Why did the damn drummers always need to rush it so much? Particularly young drummers, maybe in a hurry to get it over with. Different band members would sing lead vocals on different songs, but none of them seemed like they really wanted to. Everyone in the band looked like they just came from working in their garage, dark t-shirts in various stages of fade and tear, and dirty baggy jeans, giving Garage Band a bad name. George chuckled to himself at the joke. He wished Carly were here to tell it to. Carly Seek, the drummer in the Lucky Dogs, was George's oldest friend from high school, heck, even from grade school. They had played music together since they were sophomores, just missing a couple years in there when Carly enlisted. They had gone through several bass players over the years, even added a saxophone at one time, but it had always been George and Carly, guitar and drums, twang and boom. George looked at this guitar player, at this drummer, and thought they couldn't twang and boom if their life depended on it. George counted eight tom-toms on the drummer's kit, and about as many cymbals. The guitar player had an amp that was shoulder high, and, in addition to the one he was playing, two other guitars in waiting on high polished wood stands. He would switch to a different guitar every couple songs, but it always sounded about the same to George's ear, just various shades of shit. They were aiming this arsenal of high-volume, high-gloss equipment at the execution of the most vapid, lame pop country songs they could possibly choose. And execute them they did. Another joke Carly would appreciate. Every once in a while, they'd throw in a Seeger or Skynyrd tune to prove they could rock. "And you failed," George said out loud as the song ended, Wanda giving him an embarrassed, shut-the-fuck-up look. George could remember the exact moment that he and Carly went from being guys who listened to music to being guys who played music. They were hanging around Carly's place, literally in the garage, and there was a busted-up old guitar in the corner. "Where'd that come from?" George asked. "That wasn't here last week."
"Oh, my mom's cousin died over by Brookfield, and she had to help clean out his house," Carly answered. "Nobody wanted it, and she didn't want to trash it, so she brought it home. Thought we might mess with it."
George picked up the instrument, caked with dirt and something sticky. Besides the round sound hole in the center, there was another hole about the same size punched through the lower face of the body, and a smaller hole in the back. There were only two strings on the guitar, and from the notches George could count, there were supposed to be six. He thumbed the two strings, and they resonated at an interval that was oddly familiar to George, like the first notes of a Name That Tune. With his left thumb, he fished up and down the neck and found that melody, that guitar song called Pipeline. George was stunned that he could actually play a real song on a piece of junk with only two strings. It was like finding money laying on the ground, nobody else bothering to pick it up.
"Man, play that again," Carly said, as he slid a rusted metal folding chair to a spot in front of him.
Carly slapped out a rhythm on the chair, finding pitches and tones at different spots on the seat and back, as George took another stab at playing the simple melody.
"Hey, hey," Carly said with some excitement. "There's that place in the song where it goes doodle 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 doodle. I think it's supposed to sound like water running down a drain or a pipe. Maybe that's what the title means. Can you make that noise?"
George couldn't move his thumb fast enough, so he found a book of matches on the workbench and flipped it back and forth on the two dull strings as he slid his thumb from a high spot on the guitar neck down to the low end by those things that turn the strings. The sound he made was rough and thuddy, but glorious.
"Holy shit, that sounds just like the radio," Carly nearly yelled. "Do it again."
As George did the long doodle-doodle slide down the neck, Carly doubled it, paddling the same rhythm on the clangy metal chair. They just played that part over and over, the sound of musical boulders tumbling in an avalanche, until George's thumb got sore.
"Shit, this ain't that hard," George said,
not really to Carly, but more just to himself and to the future, a reverent acknowledgement, a word of gratitude that something so goddamn amazing could be so goddamn easy. The next time George went over to Cooperton with his mom, he bought a set of Black Diamond guitar strings at the 5 and 10 store and a book of simple chords and instructions. Carly let him take the old guitar home and get it strung up and more or less playable. George found he couldn't put it down. Any spare moment he had, before school, after school, staying up late, he messed with the guitar. He would lay it aside to go do something else, but eventually find himself back on the edge of the bed trying to get his fingers and hands to cooperate. It was frustrating and difficult and profoundly fun. Summer jobs and birthday money and some help from the folks eventually added up to enough to buy a True Tone electric guitar and a small amplifier at the Western Auto Store over in Cooperton. When George asked his dad about making the drive and the purchase, his dad said,
"Western Auto? I thought they just sold tires and lawnmowers."
Carly had borrowed an old drum kit that summer from the high school band director. His mom being on the school board probably didn't hurt. That was then. The Young Country Band was going on break now, something George always hated doing when the Lucky Dogs played. Breaks just made you sleepy, and it was more tiring to talk to a bunch of drunks than it was to just keep on playing. They had had several bar owners and party hosts insist they take a break. The bar sold more beer on break, the owners would tell him. Still, it was always a little embarrassing to know folks wanted them to stop playing. George had a few beers in him now. He told Wanda he was heading for the John, but headed for the hay wagon stage instead, wanting to intercept the band members before they wandered off.
"Hey, you guys are pretty good,"
George said loudly to the back of a long-haired head that was walking away, a sour taste in his mouth from the lie. The kid turned around. It was the bass player, and George could see that he wasn't all that much of a kid, probably more like 35 plus. The kid, the young man, looked at George and squinted.
"Well, thanks, I guess. Actually, that means something coming from you.
But we're not playing all that great tonight. We have a fill-in drummer. Nice guy, but I don't think he can count clear up to four. Besides, most of these songs suck, but that's what's on the radio and what people want to hear. I like the stuff your band plays.
What, you know my band? George was genuinely surprised, and now a little embarrassed that he had bad-mouthed and bad-minded these guys so much.
Oh, hell yes, the kid went on. I heard you play a bunch of times when I was little, you know, at the fair and stuff. I'm glad that you stuck with that old-time rock and roll. And I don't mean that crappy Seeger song. I mean Buddy and Chuck and Carl and Ventures. That's the real shit. I wish we played that stuff. I wish more people wanted to hear it.
Yeah, you and me both, George said. Not to nick your gig, but I was really hoping the Dogs would be playing here at the Beer Garden tonight. You know, for my old classmates and all. But wasn't to be, I guess.
Well, except for the Bucks, I wish he was playing here too. I think I'd rather be sitting there nursing a beer and listening to Not Fade Away than hauling all this heavy shit in and out. Our guitar player insists on this huge PA system and all the lights. It's more work hauling and setting the stuff up than it is playing the gig.
You know the old saying, we get paid for driving and lifting. The music's free. George laughed low. By the by, I'm George. What's your name, son?
It's just that. It's Sonny. Sonny Bass. Like the fish. But my bandos call me Sonny Bass, like the guitar.
Born with a showbiz name. Lucky you. And George smiled. He genuinely liked this kid.
Calcert. That's my last name, and I've heard every joke and mispronunciation possible. Cow's heart, cow's hurt, cow's tit. And every jackass thinks he's the first person to come up with it.
George grinned. So don't go starting with me.
Yeah, I wouldn't think of it. Really, I wouldn't.
Sonny gave a nervous laugh.
Say, I don't want to put you on the spot or nothing, but would you want to get up and do a tune with us next set? A couple of the other guys noticed you was here, so they'd think it pretty cool if you played one. We can probably fake it through Johnny B. Good. I mean, I don't want to embarrass you or nothing. You've heard how this drummer plays.
Sonny looked over his shoulder to make sure no one was listening. George could see that he had a deep scar running down the three quarters of his neck. I've had enough beers to make me play a little sloppy, but also to get over any stage fright. George laughed. So, yeah, what the hell? Johnny be good. Tell him it'll be in G, if it makes any difference.
That'll be great, Sonny smiled. You can at least count on the bass player to stay with you. I'll have Rick call you up early in the set before the guys get too tired or drunk. You can play one of his guitars. Really, Mr. Calcert, George, the night just got a whole lot better for me.
George headed off to the line of Port of Sands. Sonny lit up a smoke as he walked away toward a van with a trailer behind it, his bandos sitting on the bumpers and hood, drinking from red plastic cups. Nobody was saying a word. George rejoined Wanda at the table, which was slowly getting covered with empty pitchers and cups, spilled bowls of pretzels, and scraps of conversation. Sitting with them were a couple of Wanda's co-workers from the bank, Jane McCoy and Ruth Ann Woodson, both of them a few years behind George in high school. George and Wanda had been in the same class in school, and each had married their high school sweetheart. It just hadn't been each other. No, George had married Lynette right out of high school, and Wanda had married Wyman after a couple years of college. Neither marriage had lasted 3 years. When George looked back on his first marriage now, it was like it never happened. He could remember almost nothing about it, nothing that mattered. He thought it was the same for Wanda and her time with Wyman, though George never asked her about it. In fact, had learned to avoid the subject. George scanned the tables around him, counting, not with numbers, all the people he had gone to school with, known his entire life. Most were older than him. He knew them very well. He knew their middle names. Those younger than him, he tried to keep them straight. Names, order, ages, but they all got tangled up with their siblings, particularly those that moved away for several years, then came back to start their adult lives in the quiet and familiar town, with a husband or wife from another state, sometimes another country. Clarinet, trumpet, saxophone, flute, another clarinet. Strangely enough, the one thing that George could name clearly about each person he spotted was what instrument they had played in high school band. Most of the boys precipitated to the brass, trumpets and trombones, tuba and baritone, while the girls went for the higher registers, flutes, clarinets, oboes. Saxophone, that was a real mix, equal with both. Same with drums and percussion. George smile frowned at the perplexity of that. He had played trumpet in junior high, but gave it up halfway through high school. It just seemed stiff and unnatural to him, and it made his head hurt. To George, it was all math and language, not really music, more like typing class. Looking around at all these one-time tweeters and tutors and former uniform-wearing music blowers, some of whom had gone on to be in college choirs and orchestras, it seemed ridiculous, really impossible, to picture them with an instrument in their hands now. No, music was something you did before you grew up. What was that Bible verse? When I was a child, I spoke as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. Huh, I wonder what happened to me, George said, just loud enough for Wanda to say, What? George looked across the beer garden and saw, sitting at a back table, old Jacob Hayes, who had been George's bus driver for the entire span of his school years. George remembered the odd amazement he felt when he found out that old Jake had been a champion fiddle player back in his younger days. This old bus driver? This hired hand in his overalls? A fiddle player? It didn't seem possible. It had occurred then to George, who was about 12 at the time, that he didn't know anyone outside of high school, save the four or five women who played piano at the various churches, who played any kind of an instrument. He had asked his father about it. Why was that? What happened?
TV. That's what happened, his father had answered. Before TV, people got together on the weekends and played music or listened to someone else play music, and people danced. Heck, 100 years ago, every little town had its own brass band or banjo and fiddle band to play for dances and celebrations and the like. And in every family, there was somebody, your grandpa or your aunt or uncle or cousin, who played something. That was real common, even 30 years ago.
Was that fun? George asked. At that point, George had never even seen a banjo or fiddle, except on TV.
Heck yes, it was fun, and it was all we knew, his father continued. We didn't have anything to compare it to, except each other. But when TV came along, I guess it was just easier to stay home. And the folks on TV, they were so much better than your local musicians. It made everybody just feel like quitting.
Well, George thought for a moment, radio had been around for a long, long time, and that didn't make people want to quit playing. What was the difference?
Huh. Well, I never really thought about it like that.
His father took a pause.
I guess the difference was, you couldn't see them playing on the radio, and you could imagine it was you. And besides, lots of old-time local musicians did play on the radio. KOQL over in Cooperton, they had locals play at the station all the time, before records took over.
How do you know that? George asked.
I was in a band before I met your mom, his father said, louder, with a touch of exasperation in his voice or something close.
You might as well have told George that his father had been President of the United States, but forgot to mention it. His dad, in a band. That was even harder to picture than old Jake being a fiddler.
How come I didn't know that? George asked him. Oh, it was a long time ago, and I didn't do it for very long. I played doghouse bass in a swingy kind of bluegrass band. I picked that because I thought it would be easiest to learn, easiest to fake on. I didn't consider how big the dang thing was to haul. So, you know, jobs and you kids came along and there was no room to keep something that big around. But, huh, now you got me thinking about it, remembering. It sure was fun.
Hey, these boys are pretty good.
Not really.
George felt hands on his shoulders and knew without turning around that it was Carly.
That drummer sucks.
I thought you was out of town, at a wedding, George said.
When the Lucky Dogs hadn't landed the beer garden gig, Carly had told George it was just as well his niece was getting married that weekend. But George knew that Carly would have skipped the wedding if the gig had happened. Carly loved playing every bit as much as George did, and always seemed anxious to get out of the house. "Hey, Carly, they've asked me to get up and play a song with them, probably real shortly now. Come on up with me. I'm sure they'll let you sit in on drums, and I'd feel a whole lot better with you up there. I don't know if this guy is a jazz player or what, but he can't play a simple beat to save his life."
"You know what John Lennon said? Jazz is shit music, even stupider than rock and roll."
And Carly laughed. "Did he really say that?" And George saw Sonny, the bass player, waving him to the stage. "Okay, let's go be stupid." George headed across the gravel, Carly in tow. They stepped up some concrete blocks to the back of the narrow stage, Sonny smiling as they approached.
"Hey, this is my buddy Carl. He plays in our band. Is it okay if he sits in on drums?"
"Gladly,"
the suspect drummer said without a pause, slamming his sticks down loudly on the floor tom-tom.
"I hate playing that old shit. Fucking Johnny Be Good. If I never heard that song again..."
And his voice trailed off as he jumped down from the stage and walked away into the darkness.
"Hope he comes back someday,"
Carly laughed.
"Ah, don't mind him. He's a frustrated jazz musician," Sonny said.
"Nailed it," said George. He introduced himself to Rick, the guitar player.
There's only one input on my amp. We can't plug in two guitars, so I'm going to sit this one out, too."
"No offense," Rick said. George started looking over the three very expensive instruments that Rick owned, trying to choose the one that might feel the most familiar to him. As he did this, Rick reached behind the bookcase-sized amplifier and brought out a battered cardboard guitar case.
"Here," Rick said bluntly. "You play this one."
"No, that's okay," George replied, barely hearing him, still studying the exotic guitars on their polished wood stands. "I'm sure one of these will work fine."
"Again, no offense," Rick went on, "but I make it a firm policy to not let anyone else touch my guitars."
And he pushed the scuffed cardboard case, missing the handle, into George's arms.
"You play this one," Rick repeated.
"You're fucking kidding me."
But George kept this as a thought, not spoken. He might have replied in anger, but when Rick said, "a firm policy," and said it with such seriousness, it was all George could do to not bust out laughing.
"Okay, whatever."
Rick just stood there, apparently to make sure George adhered to policy. George pushed some cups aside and lay the case on the wagon floor. Opening the case was like opening the page of an old school yearbook or walking into a house your family had occupied years ago. The guitar inside was just like the old True Tone that George and his dad had picked out at the Western Auto store years ago. George's was red, this one was blue-green. George had traded his to some kid for a record player when he moved on to a more professional instrument. Rick detached the strap from one of his real guitars and handed it to George. Apparently, the policy did not apply to guitar straps. George smiled at the thought. George plugged in, tuned up, turned some knobs. As he did this, the keyboard player, one of those sunglasses at night kind of guys, got up and left without a word. George looked over to Carly, shrugged and laughed.
"Man, I'm sorry. I thought Teddy was sticking around for this," Sonny apologized. "In G, right? Just not our destiny to ever play in more than a trio,"
Carly said, side-eyeing George and grinning. Sonny stepped up to the microphone.
"I think you know these guys."
And that was all. And enough. No count-off. Just the eternally relighting fuse. The holy damned twang that started every Chuck Berry song. And they were off. Sonny was right there, knowing that his first note was not G, the key of the song, but C, the fourth above, that step up. That immediate suspension, that lift, that thang that gave every listener, every dancer, every kid, everybody who never had to know the how and why, the feeling that they had just made a lucky leap onto an already speeding train. The song started, just like Chuck recorded it, with a get-happy guitar solo before any words were ever sung. George could play that opening solo note for note, just like Chuck, and that's what he did. Like he was quoting scripture, not one iota. By the time the vocal verse started up and the story unfolded and was told, Carly was playing with his eyes closed and Sonny was walking the bass like he was laughing. Thinking about it later, after he went back to rejoin Wanda at the table, George didn't actually remember playing the song, so much as he just remembered it ending. The fading last note setting him back down into humid reality. The few dancers on the floor walking back to their seats. Applause that sounded like wet firecrackers.
"And that was George and Carl from the legendary Lucky Dogs,"
Sonny had said over the microphone.
That was something,"
Sonny described it perfectly.
"Now let's see if I can locate..."
And that's when George stopped paying attention. George made his way back through the tables, smiling and nodding at people as he went, his self-consciousness fading with the spotlight of the moment. By the time he reached the table where Wanda was still sitting with her friends, he was back to yellow bug lights and the occasional flick of a lighter.
"You sounded great, honey. You really did,"
Wanda said with a smile that George tried not to see as pity.
"I love that old chef. Ruth Ann and I were dancing in our seats. Woo-hoo-hoo!"
Jane said with a drunken lilt, bordering on slur.
"Really, babe, it sounded great,"
Wanda went on.
"I'm sure everybody was glad to hear you play."
Okay, you don't have to feel sorry for me. I didn't ask." George was surprised at the words coming out of his mouth and quickly put his hand on Wanda's knee. I'm sorry. You didn't need that. I don't know. Sometimes I just don't know. And I don't even know what."
"I do know, George,"
Wanda said. He could see the hurt in her eyes from being snapped at. "But they'd been together a long time now." She really did understand. Music meant a lot to him, and it didn't always sit in a comfortable place.
"Hey, I think Jane needs to go home now, before she embarrasses herself or throws up or starts hitting on somebody, or all three," Wanda said. "But she shouldn't be driving, and she brought Ruth Ann with her, and Ruth can't drive a stick. So I was thinking I'd drive them each home in Jane's car, then I'll just go on home myself. We'll run the car back to her tomorrow. You okay with that? You can stay and shut the place down. Maybe they'll get you up to play another one."
No. One was quite enough. "Say, did you see where Carly went? He got off the stage quicker than I did."
"Yeah, I saw him going out the front entrance, kind of like he was in a hurry."
"Oh, he's always in a hurry," George said. "But he doesn't rush." Another thought, another joke Carly would appreciate. Wanda got up and, with some effort, got Jane and Ruth Ann moving toward the exit. George sat and tried to listen to a couple more songs, but it was just making him nervous and edgy. He finished his beer, then headed for the gate. Out on the street, just a few yards past the exit, where the rattle of the band dropped off and the scratchy voices of people talking over each other didn't carry, it was suddenly and surprisingly quiet. George was in the middle of the darkened carnival, all shadowy metal skeletons and closed-up shacks of distraction. The smell of corn dogs, that was still there. Thick black cables were snakes on the asphalt. George walked through the kiddie rides, by the train and the merry-go-round. He reached through a barrier fence and gave one of the tubs of fun a spin. The Ferris wheel was set up around the corner of the block, where there was more high clearance. It arced like a burned-out rainbow over the buildings at the end of the street. As George got closer, he could see Carly sitting in one of the bench seats, several feet up, rocking just a bit. It wasn't all that high, but definitely required some climbing. George was surprised Carly hadn't gone for the top.
"What the fuck are you doing, Carly? You're going to get in trouble."
George realized he sounded like he was 15, and that he'd been saying these same words to Carly for years now, decades.
"Come on up, Georgie. The view is spectacular." "And one of the carnival guys already yelled at me, then told me I wasn't worth the effort. And I'm not."
"The view, huh? What, the lumberyard and that gravel pile?"
"Oh, but it looks entirely different from up here."
George sighed and shook his head. But what the fuck got the best of him? He stepped through a gap in the barrier fence, got a grip on a cable, then a cross beam, and started working his way up. He reached the level where Carly was sitting and gingerly eased himself off the strut and into the swinging seat. Like all things climbable, it looked a lot higher from up here than it did from the ground.
"Yeah, great view," George said flatly, panting a little.
Carly leaned way back in the seat, causing it to tip crazy far.
"God damn it, stop it!" George shouted, grabbing onto the edges of the seat. "What's wrong with you?"
His reading glasses took a dive from his shirt pocket. Carly laughed like a boy and a madman.
"Woo-hoo!"
The laughter echoed between the old brick buildings and disappeared down an alley.
"That kid was pretty good on base," Carly went on. "Maybe we should ask him to join us. I'm getting the feeling old Les isn't digging the gigging, if you know what I mean. What would this be, our fifth bass player?"
George settled down into the seat, lowering his center of gravity.
"Les hadn't said anything to me about quitting, and there hadn't been much gigging to speak of this summer."
They sat there in silence for several minutes. Though not all that high in the air, George looked down the crossing streets, a different perspective, past the darkened carnival to where the asphalt gave out to gravel, crossed the railroad tracks, and disappeared into the dark of the country. Carly reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out two airline-sized bottles of Crown Royal, handing one to George.
"How come every time I'm around you, I feel like I'm back in high school trying to get away with shit? Where'd you get those?"
"Oh, some flight, I suppose."
Lids off, Carly offered a toast, a tap of plastic. A night breeze came up, warm air, cool air mixing around them. The sound of the country band was a little louder up here and was doing a strange delay and repeat as it bounced between the buildings.
"This is like hearing a bad song twice at the same time," Carly said,
and George had to laugh.
"Yeah, that's about right."
Carly gave his empty a hard toss, and it pinged off the metal awning of the hardware store.
"How long are we going to do this, George?"
"Oh, I don't know. I can probably sit here until the sun comes up. Really, about 10 more minutes, then I need to be heading home, if we don't die getting down."
"No, I don't mean this."
Carly was suddenly serious.
"I mean playing. The band, the parties, the bars and such. How much longer are we going to keep at it? I mean, you know me, I'll play most any time, anywhere. But you don't seem to enjoy it much anymore."
"What are you talking about?" George said. But he knew.
Carly took a breath, then went at it.
"We usually start out all right, but then you always got to take it so damn serious. You've usually bummed me out entirely by the end of a night, scowling and stomping your foot, giving me dirty looks. Hell, giving the crowd dirty looks."
"I do not," George was emphatic. "Well, maybe to you, but not to the crowd. I get frustrated when you start getting drunk and the tempo goes all to shit. I can't help it. That matters to me."
"The crowd can't tell if you're looking at me or looking at them."
Carly was getting riled now.
"But I guarantee you they know when you're pissed off. I don't know why you can't just drink some beers and play some songs and say fuck it and have a good time. That's what I do."
"Yeah, I know that's what you do. But somebody's got to drive home, just like somebody's got to book the damn gig, juggle everybody's calendar, deal with whoever is paying us at the end of the night, glad hand all the birthday boys and happy couples, and remember the words to all those fucking songs. You can't do all that and be drunk."
George was snorting now, breathing heavy through his nose.
"Yeah, I know what you want," George huffed, going after Carly. "You just want a reason to be out of the house so you can fuck around on Pam, flirt with women half your age, get drunk, and pretend. And hell, I can't even figure out what you're pretending. It's fucking embarrassing to watch."
George was nearly panting now, but Carly didn't say anything. He just started very slowly to rock the seat. Up and down, not very far.
"You do realize,"
Carly said, soft and slow,
"that we're having this conversation sitting in a Ferris wheel seat 30 feet off the ground. I don't think we're going to wrestle this one out.
and probably not a good idea to start throwing punches.
George's mouth was a tight circle. He was holding his breath. Then he let it out, let it all out. He dropped his head and looked over the edge of the seat, seeing his glasses on the street below them, beside a bucket of sand. George leaned forward, way forward. So did Carly, and the seat tipped, and tipped farther. George hoped the lap bar would hold. They just sat there, staring down at the tangle and trash and wires and shadows below them. Carly spit and watched it fall. George sat back, and the seat leveled. He threw his head back and stared straight up into the dark sky, too bright here to see many stars.
Oh, fuck, Carly, I don't know. I guess it's black and white. Either you play or you don't play. Pretty simple. I can't imagine not playing music, but to tell you the truth, I'm usually dreading it by the time the gig rolls around. I just want to feel something, you know? I mean, I feel a lot of things. Wanda and I are solid. The kids are finally off and doing all right. And I can stomach the insurance biz for a few more years. But playing music, well, I'm not telling you nothing. I mean, it's about playing, but it's also about waiting. Waiting for those moments when it's all just right. When you stop thinking and it's all just slide and shine. Sometimes that happens 10 times a night. Sometimes it doesn't happen at all. But it sure as shit doesn't happen if you're not playing.
Several quiet seconds passed.
Sounds like a gambling addiction,
Carly said. George went on like he hadn't even heard him.
I mean, I did feel it tonight when we played that song for, what, the 5,000th time? That was the best we'd ever played that. Isn't it funny? 4,999th? Nope. 5,000th? Yep. And there you go. It's all about waiting, about being there when it happens.
You think too much, Carly said. You think the fun right out of it.
Yeah, probably. I'm going home.
George went back the way he came, carefully passing his hands from cable to strut to crossbar, boots finally touching pavement. He walked off, his reading glasses crunching under his heel, not even looking down. But George did look up at Carly one more time. Carly's eyes were closed, and he was smiling just a little, the same look he'd had on his face when they played so well tonight.
Don't fall, George said, out into the air.
Heading out of town, back to the farm, George almost made it to the railroad tracks before the crossing arm came down. But he didn't, and would have to wait until the freight made its plodding way through the town before he could continue home. Years ago, the train had barreled through at high speed. It didn't seem like they slowed down at all. But someone had told George that the tracks and crossings were rougher now, less maintained, less dependable, and the trains were required to drop down to a low speed at every town.
What now? George said, as the long freight slowed,
and came to a full stop on the crossing. George couldn't remember the last time that had happened.
Oh, jeez,
he sighed, and put the truck in park. He was ready to be in bed. After a few minutes, the train started up again, but slowly, so slowly. George watched each car, read the numbers, tried to decipher the graffiti on the tanks and boxes. He reached his hand behind the bench seat, feeling around. Yep, it was still there. He had thrown his guitar in the truck tonight. He wasn't sure why. Just in case, you know, just in case. George opened the truck door and stepped out, leaned the seat forward and pulled the guitar case out from behind it. He walked up to the crossing arm, watching as the cars passed in a sluggish parade. He was waiting for... Yes, here came one. A boxcar with an open door. When it came up to where George was standing, he chucked the guitar case into the black inside of the boxcar and didn't hear it land. He got back in the truck and waited. The train finally passed, and George went on home.